Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the first academic conference call of the semester. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, cfr.org, if you'd like to share it with your colleagues or classmates. We are delighted to have Ed Hussein and Rob Dineen with us to talk about the crisis in Syria. Ed Hussein is CFR Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies. Prior to coming to CFR, Mr. Hussein was co-founder and co-director of the Quilliam Foundation, the world's first counter-radicalization think tank. Formerly an activist in Islamic groups, he has now become a strong critic of extremism. He is the author of The Islamist, which was a finalist for the George Orwell Prize for Political Writing. His next book is entitled The Sufis. It will be published later this year. And he is tweets at @Ed_Hussein, so I hope you will follow him there. Robert M. Dineen is CFR's Inai Enrico Mattai Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies. From April 2008 until August 2010, Dr. Dineen headed the Jerusalem Mission of the Quartet. He previously served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs. He's also served at the National Security Council for some time. He tweets at Robert Dineen and writes the CFR blog Middle East Matters, which you can find, again, on our homepage of our website. So, Ed and Rob, thank you very much for being with us today. As noted from the turnout for this call, there's considerable interest in the situation in Syria and where the crisis is, how it's escalating and what the outcome will be there. So why don't I turn it over first to you, Ed, to make your comments, and then we'll go to Rob.
Irina, thank you, and thank you to everyone who's on the call. I think I'll just say three things broadly. The first is the current state of play. This weekend, those of us who monitor the situation inside Syria and the wider region were surprised by the fact that Muad al-Khatib, the current opposition leader, was willing now to negotiate with the Assad regime via the Iranians and the Russians. Now, the details are that he asked for the release of 160,000 opposition prisoners and travel documents for many Syrians in the opposition movement. But I think what's important here is that, yes, those of us in the West might find what he's saying to be unpalatable. Many of our friends in the Gulf countries and Turkey might feel let down by his move. But ultimately, he's a realist, he's a pragmatist, and he was put in that position for those traits. And I think those traits lead him to realize that as matters stand, on the battleground inside Syria now, the opposition movement, with all the support from extreme elements and others, has not yet defeated the Assad force. So contrary to popular expectation at the outset, Assad still remains in power and to some extent in control of key parts of Syria. And therefore, the killing that's being unleashed on large numbers of Syrians and the instability and the 2 million displaced people and the nearly million refugees around in different countries now means that he has to take consideration for what's going on inside Syria for his people that he wants to ultimately lead. And I think what he's done, however disagreeable to those of us who live outside Syria, I think gives him the moral high ground and gives Muad al-Khatib the perception amongst ordinary Syrians that this is not a man interested in perennial warfare and control, but wants to reach a state of interplay where Assad and he can be in a position of negotiation and come to a peaceful settlement rather than want war. Whether that happens or not, we don't know. But the fact that he's made that offer casts him as a leader in contrast to Assad's mode over the last 18 months. I think it's important to pay attention to when Muad al-Khatib takes this, especially with the Iranians and the Russians being involved. Also worth noting that he met with Joe Biden this weekend in Munich. The second point I want to make is that there's often an accusation that the United States is doing nothing. And I don't think that's true. I'm not trying to defend the administration here. I think the administration could probably do more. But it's worth noting again that the U.S. alone is the single largest contributor to the humanitarian catastrophe that's unfolding. I think $365 million to date. Second point is a non-lethal amount of assistance that's been provided to rebel fighters. If you phone most of the satellite phones that the rebel fighters and their commanders use, those are Washington, D.C. numbers, you know, given to them by different players in Washington, D.C. Thirdly, the uniting or trying to unite the opposition, hideous task, but trying to unite them for a day after Assad. Fifthly, the chemical weapons stockpile, keeping an eye on it, also knowing where they are, and more importantly, and my last point on this, is the contingency plans that have been put in place, that if Assad were to use them or to move them, or if they were to fall in rogue hands, as it were. I mean, all of those points are important points to note. The broader point, of course, is not getting militarily involved at this stage does not necessarily mean that the U.S. is standing by and watching this, which is often an argument that is played out, and I just don't think it holds up to scrutiny. And my last point is the Israeli strike recently on an alleged convoy of weapons heading out towards Hezbollah. And also Netanyahu's remarks yesterday on when Bulgaria implicated Hezbollah attacking 7 Israeli tourists and killing, I think, 30-plus in July of last year, combined with the pressure now from Bulgaria on Hezbollah and the pressure now from Israel directly going inside Syrian territory and attacking a likely weapons convoy towards Hezbollah, means that there could be retaliation from either Iran or from Syria or from Hezbollah, or all of them, or indeed none of them. Whichever way it plays out, what this indicates to us is greater Israeli interest, direct interest in what's going on inside Syria. Yes, they want Assad to go, but it's worrying what will happen after Assad. And the Israelis talking about setting up a buffer zone and therefore setting the precedent for greater direct international or regional involvement inside Syria, I think, is one to watch in coming months.
Thank you, Ed. Robert, over to you.
Great. Okay, thank you very much. Well, Ed has given a very an excellent and comprehensive overview on the situation on the ground, and as usual, Ed and I tend to agree on most things related to Syria and indeed the region. I think, you know, from the perspective of sitting in Washington and as a someone formerly involved as a Syria analyst and then as a policymaker involved on Syria, I mean, what is happening today, you know, first has to be recognized as a true policy dilemma. There are some problems, and Syria is perhaps the greatest embodiment of that, of a problem that is really hard. I mean, it sounds banal, if not ridiculous, to say. But there are some issues in which it is, you know, there's a clear option. There are some issues in which, you know, you can debate the pros and cons. This is one in which the choices seem to be between bad and worse, and one in which no one really professes to have a good solution. And so all one has are different palliatives or emphases. But it's not as if there's a single, forgive the term, magic bullet that one can put forward as the way forward. You know, on the positive side of the ledger sheet, the situation in Syria is a strategic opportunity, if you will, given American and Western objectives, which is to bring Syria out of the Iranian orbit, to break the Iranian influence in the Arab heartland. Syria provides a bridge into Lebanon, into the Arab world, and you know, bringing down Assad and bringing down the Iranian-Syrian alliance could be a real strategic opportunity given our larger strategic interests vis-a-vis Iran. There's also a humanitarian interest here. I mean, obviously, 60,000 people plus have been killed, and the United States and the international community cares and should care. And standing back while this happens is extremely painful and frustrating, if not questionable. Part ways slightly, but only slightly, with Ed is on the U.S. role. I believe that we have been a little too passive when it comes to Syria, and I think that's driven by very understandable concerns. I mean, one of it has been an overall strategic reorientation away from from the Middle East, wanting to pull out of conflicts rather than get into further conflicts. I mean, we've just been in a 10-year war with Iraq, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and now, you know, the United States and the American people are very reluctant to get involved further. That said, I think the debate has become and has been treated too much as a either we get involved all the way with boots on the ground, military intervention, or not. Similarly, the debate has been about whether or not to support the opposition, and then we see all the divisions, the problems with the opposition, and say, who is it that we would assist? I think that analysis is one I subscribe to for a period of time, but I think the situation on the ground has changed. And now we're in a situation where this has become a full-out war, and it's going to be resolved in one of two ways, or a combination of the two. One is through a diplomatic process, and the second is on the ground. And right now, I think the United States has been weak on both fronts. We've been able to point to the Russian position as a way to sort of justify inactivity on the diplomatic front, and that's largely justified. That said, I think we need to be doing more to mobilize international public opinion and for the day after. There is the question about the inevitability of Assad's demise. From day one, the administration has talked about the inevitability of Assad's demise. I have been and remain skeptical about any sort of inevitability. I think he will go, but there's nothing self-implementing about that. And doing nothing will reinforce the possibility that he will stay. And if indeed that is U.S. policy, as the president has said almost 2 years ago, then we need to be doing more to accelerate that, but also doing more to prepare for the day after. I'm sorry to go on so long here, but I think it's just important to set out a framework. Similarly, I think there's more on the ground that we can be doing short of intervening militarily. But perhaps I will stop at this point and leave it, leave some on the plate for our Q&A.
Great. Thank you so much. Chantel, let's open up to the students on the call.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we'd like to open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star 2. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Our first question will come from Robin Holzhauer, State Department.
Hi, this is Elaine Jones, and I'd like to ask about the opposition and how effectively we can sort out who are the who are not, and if we some and not the others, then how do we know where our help is going, and at the end of the day, what do we see coming together in Syria on the day after? And in light of that also, how much of this is falling into it? Thank you.
I'm sorry.
The last bit of your question, we lost you. Can you just repeat the last part of it?
Yeah, the last part is just how much do you see this as a Sunni-Shia problem? When you look at the two sides and who's supporting who, to what extent do you see this as a war between the Sunnis and the Shia?
I can do the last bit of the question if Rob does the first part, because I didn't catch the first part. So I think
okay.
Does that work, Rob?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, I guess, broadly put, the question is, you know, how do you get involved when you don't know who it is you're trying to help within the opposition? And I agree with that. I mean, that has been a real problem. And frankly, for a good part of the time, let's say the first 18 months of this struggle, I've opposed providing military assistance to the opposition for that very reason. It's fractured. We don't know where it is. There's the danger of blowback. There's the danger of the day after. We've seen in cases like Afghanistan in the 1980s and other conflicts where we topple a leader using military assistance only to find that military assistance then have unintended consequences that we pay for later. Those are all compelling arguments. And it's an argument against putting ships of weapons on shiploads of, on airplanes and boats and handing them over to some opposition. What I think we need to be doing, though, more so, because the developments have taken place on the ground in which other actors, particularly in the region, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks, others have been funneling weapons to the opposition, that now it's no longer a case of them not getting arms. Arms have become the tool and the currency of influence. And so in order to help have influence for the day after, I think getting on the ground is important. How do you do that? Well, part of that is through covert means, having people on the ground covertly who are working with the opposition. It's an opportunity to therefore get to know the opposition, to vet the opposition, to determine which elements within the opposition are worth and worthy of working with, which are worth and worthy of avoiding. There's a problem with al-Nusra, who's just been designated a terrorist organization. This is a very messy situation. But I think there are ways, there are certain strawman arguments such as, well, we can't provide, surface-to-air missiles to the opposition because they'll use them later against Western interests. That's a danger, but these dangers can be mitigated by having people on the ground, by giving arms in limited numbers that can be disabled afterwards through electronic means. So what I'm arguing for is a very cautious engagement with the opposition on the ground, but one that gives us at least a role in shaping the situation today and preparing for the day after. And just briefly, and I don't want to step on your toes, but I think what's made Syria so problematic is this: this is not just a conflict between a regime and a population, but between this is a very Syria is a heterogeneous population, and one in which many communities, all of whom hate Assad, are also living in greater fear about the day after. And as much as getting rid of Assad has to be an objective, I think we need to keep in mind in all these kind of conflicts that what happens afterwards is really what we need to be focusing on, because Assad leaving tomorrow will not necessarily in and of itself make the situation in Syria better for our interests or for the Syrian people. Ed, please.
Rob, thank you for that. In terms of is this a Sunni versus Shia conflict, when it started off, it wasn't. In Daraa, it was about corruption. It was allowing the young children at the school to be free to speak out against the Assad regime. When the intelligence agencies came into the school in Daraa back in 18 months ago and wiped off graffiti on the wall that was anti-government, only calling for reform, not even for the fall of the government, but for reform. And the secret intelligence service, the Mukhabarat, found that intolerable. The protest spread because of the level of intolerance shown by the government, and it moved by incidents in Tunisia and also in Egypt, but it was part of the greater Arab Spring as it was seen then. And it wasn't about Sunni-Shia dynamics, but it was very quickly made to be like that by others in the region, not least Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey. But more importantly, the silence of Iraq is very telling. The neighboring country that the U.S. helped, quote-unquote, liberate and remove Saddam Hussein now feels the need not to call for the fall of Assad because they worry about Assad's Syria or a post-Assad Syria, providing a strategic base for Sunnis inside Syria to help Sunni rebels inside Iraq and then destabilize the Maliki or a future regime. So that element, added to that, the Iranian support, unfettered support for the Alawi Assad government has made it into a more of a Shia-Sunni dynamic regionally.
But I think the funding by different and the support by different parties, Iraq and Iran on one side directly and indirectly, and the Sunni governments, whether it's Egypt, Morsi speaking out in direct terms, or whether it's Turkey providing a base for the Muslim Brotherhood as well as the Syrian opposition groups, whether it's the Gulf countries providing arms, as Rob just mentioned, and finances to sometimes the most extreme elements within the Sunni fighters. What's happened now is that conflict has taken that shape. But I think it's still worth remembering that the Shia, the vast majority of the Shia across the Arab world and beyond, do not consider Hafez al-Assad's son, Bashar al-Assad, to be Shia. They see them to be an external sect, you know, on the margins or on the outside of Islam, you know. So there is that element that it wasn't because he was Shia, because even the Shia did not think he was Shia, never mind the Sunni think he was Shia. But there are other elements, of course. The Druze, the Christian, and other minorities also have a stake in this conflict along sectarian lines. And my last point would be this, on this answer, and that is, where the conflict is heading isn't necessarily inside Syria towards Sunni-Shia dynamics, although that will be an important part. But the Shia and other communities are important, but numerically not as significant as the Sunnis. And post-Assad Syria would be a contention between different Sunni factions. And my worry is that, much like we're seeing developments inside Egypt, a contest for power between different secular organizations and a varied Islamist organization, Salafis, Sufis, Islamists, and others, I worry that we will see something along that black and white line playing out more, but with different shades of gray thrown in between because of the presence of Al-Qaeda fighters now that will want their bite of the cake once the power struggle becomes more visible.
Thank you both. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from Penn State School of International.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you both for speaking to everyone today. To kind of expand on an idea that you both touched upon and to play the devil's advocate, is it the U.S.'s responsibility to intervene? And if so, what effective means of intervention are we discussing? Because frankly speaking, a good amount of the time, U.S. intervention in the Middle East has a track record of not being arguably to America's benefit. So wouldn't intervention in Syria just be another arguably failed mission by the U.S.?
Who wants to take that?
Well, go ahead, Rob. Okay, just briefly, I mean, it's a fair question. It's a good point. I mean, first of all, I would say, what I tried to say was that, you know, there are two basic interests here from the U.S. perspective. One is a strategic one, given the serious geostrategic position in terms of Iran. Also, and then there's a second one, which is the humanitarian one. We've had 60,000 people killed. We have over 2 million refugees. The strain this is putting on not just the Syrian people, but neighboring countries, Jordan, Turkey, Lebanon, some violence spillover into Israel, some spillover into Iraq, is enormous. So the stakes here are quite critical. Does the U.S. have a responsibility to intervene? No more so than the international community has a responsibility to protect under the UN principle of the responsibility to protect. Do we have an interest in involving ourselves? That to me is the question, and there I would say yes. But then the question is how. You know, what I tried to frame is a notion that, you know, should we commit to military intervention in which U.S. troops go into Syria? No, absolutely not. I want to be brief, so I'll just leave it as no. But at the same time, is it in our interest or even becoming of who we are to stand back and do nothing while the various interests and humanitarian concerns that I outlined go unaddressed? I would argue no as well. There we, you know, so in between doing nothing and intervening entirely, I think there is we do have an interest.
Yeah. Why don't we take the next question, because we have, unless, Ed, you want to add anything, we have a lot of questions in queue.
No, let's get more questions in.
Great, thank you. Next question, Chantel.
Next question is coming from University of Minnesota.
Hi. Given Khatib's recent talk that he would be willing to enter into negotiations with the Assad regime, specifically the vice president, and the likelihood that diplomatic solutions would not take place without the help of Russia or Iran, what is the chance that the U.S. would become significantly involved in such relations?
If I may, Rob.
Please.
I mean, if I understand the question correctly, it's not. If the Syrian opposition, led by Muad al-Khatib, however many factions may disagree with him, want to enter into a negotiation with Assad that at least brings about a temporary halt to the fighting, allows them to regroup, allows them to expose the government for the current Assad government for its flaws, brings the Russians and the Iranians on board, and therefore allows for greater international pressure from the United Nations Security Council going forward. I mean, there's in the short term, there's no harm done for that to be pursued, and I can't prove this, but my hunch is Muad al-Khatib has maintained exceptionally close ties to the U.S. State Department, and you know, in public, he's recently met with Joe Biden. I don't think, given the level of U.S. support that's gone in behind him and the people around him, I don't think he went out and made this kind of a gesture without some kind of consultation with his U.S. and Arab backers, rather. So it is in the interest of the United States, for the short term at least, to try to bring about the end to the violence and enter into a stage of what's been called as, you know, peaceful transition. Whether Assad will do that or not, I doubt it. But, you know, every effort is worthwhile in order to get to the kind of Syria that everyone involved in this conflict wants to see. Whether it will happen or not is another question. I doubt very much it will. But, you know, nothing should be taken off the table, including the kind of outreach that's being suggested, which is, you know, out of the blue, counterintuitive, bold, and more importantly, offers a glimmer of hope to ordinary Syrians that perhaps someone like Muad al-Khatib could be a different kind of leader for their country.
Next question.
Thank you. Our next question will come from University for Petroleum.
Hello. Okay, my question is about Russia and China. It's obvious that any solution involves the UN. Russia and China are blocking any.
I'm sorry, it looks like we had some strong interference coming from that line. Our next question will come from Eastern Mediterranean University.
Hi. I read your insightful articles, especially No Easy Answers in Syria, was very inspiring. It has been mentioned that conflict could last a couple of more years. However, only thing that made me curious is that there seems to be no formulation to the rising tensions in Syria, and also a suggestion and to end the conflict. And one last thing that I would like to ask is that what constructive role could Turkey play in order to draw an end to the conflict? Thank you.
Ed, why don't you go ahead?
Sure. Thank you, Rob. Sorry to the questioner about the Russia and China. I mean, it was an interesting angle. Sorry we didn't catch the question. The role of Turkey is absolutely vital to all of this. Not least because Turkey shares a border with Syria, not least because of Turkey's historical involvement in Syria over the last 400 and more years. The Kurdish population between Syria and Turkey and the movement between those two populations, the creation now in the northeastern region of Syria of a Kurdish province of sorts that worries Ankara, will this become a home for PKK terrorist types? But also, the Syrian opposition movements have enjoyed vast amounts of support, both monetary and some would say military, though we can't prove that yet. I mean, Rob might have another view.
for the opposition movements, and I think that an interesting ideological link that the Turkish government of the AK party is off the centre-right or the more moderate Islamist leaning. I mean, they would object to being described as Islamists, but they're inspired by some role of Islam in the public space. And the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood looks to them for a level of steer. So for all of those kind of reasons, I think Turkey is an interesting and important and indispensable actor in this current conflict. But despite Turkish membership of NATO, despite U.S. sending of Patriot missiles as support for Turkey, there has not been any direct Turkish military involvement into Syria, nor has the Arab League plus Turkey come into any form of direct involvement in trying to uproot the Assad regime. So Turkey's role is absolutely vital, but Turkey on its own, without European plus U.S. backing, cannot act. And it just allows me for a minute or so to respond to the question we had a while back, and that was, you know, the U.S. involvement. I don't think the U.S. necessarily has to be involved directly. The allies such as Turkey, the Arab League, allies in the European Union countries, with all of their faults and flaws, should be pushed to take the lead. The U.S. can stay one removed from this conflict and provide greater strategic leadership without putting blood or greater treasure at risk. We've seen this happen in Mali on a smaller case recently with France. We've seen Britain's preparedness to go into other countries. We've seen both those countries to some extent lead, but with greater U.S. support in Libya. The examples are there that other countries, especially the Gulf countries, the Arab League, Turkey, at a push, the European Union, they ought to be at the forefront. And it's not necessarily to be expected that every time there's a conflict in any given country and there are uprisings and there are killings and there are demands for the regime to fall and there are huge protests, that it then falls on Washington, D.C. and the American taxpayer to go and salvage that country. I don't think it's in the interests of the U.S., nor is it in the interests of global peace, nor is it in the interest of individual countries that will face these tensions down the road. I'm thinking about Saudi Arabia. I'm thinking about China. And to set this kind of precedent from Libya to Tunisia to Egypt, whenever there's conflict, the U.S. is the first to be involved in some way or another, I don't think carves out a system within international relations that allows for greater autonomy within countries and increases dependency on the U.S. when that should not be in the interests of countries or the United States.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. We'll try again to take the question from University for Petroleum.
Yes. Good afternoon. My question is, what kind of contingencies does Israel and U.S. have in place should the Syrian governance fall in the wrong hands?
Thank you.
Go ahead, Rob.
I think what is clear is that the United States, Israel, and other countries in the region have been coordinating quite assiduously to prepare for certain worst-case scenarios, given the strength of Syria's army, its arsenal of weapons of mass destruction, and the danger that these weapons could either be employed as a last-gasp, desperate act, or by transferring them to rogue elements or terrorist organizations or militias, whatever your nomenclature. The United States has identified as a red line for its own action use or weaponization of Syria's weapons of mass destruction, and Israel has drawn a similar red line. As we've seen from recent developments last week with Israel's strike within Syria, the transfer of weapons of mass destruction or advanced weapons, in this case, the interference is quite strong here. The transfer of, in this case, what was SA-17 surface-to-air missiles was something that Israel considered crossed its level of tolerability. I think in this instance, Israel was also sending a very strong message to the Syrian regime, which is that it will not allow or tolerate such transfers in the future. So it should not contemplate that. Whether or not there should be or is or should be a broader definition of triggers to intervention is unclear to me. So far, it's all centered around both the weapons of mass destruction and their possible transfer to third parties. But
thank
I would
you.
Say, just by adding, it's clear that there are a high level of engagement that's taking place both between Washington and Israel and between Washington and other parties, other countries in the Arab world and in the region.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question will come from Richard Stockton College.
Hi. Do you think what's happening in Syria threatens democratization in the region, or is there an outcome of the Syrian conflict that might in the future?
Did you say threatens democratization in the region?
Yes.
Rob, shall I go ahead?
Take a crack. I might also want to say
sure.
a word or two.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I'll be very brief. There's a wider ideational problem here in most of these so-called new democracies or emerging democracies, whether it's Tunisia, whether it's Libya, whether it's Egypt, and that is the belief that somehow just having elections, whether they're free and fair is disputable, but whether just having elections and having majorities in power somehow delivers democracy. We've seen a failure to understand the meaning of democracy in the sense of rights for minorities, however much you disagree with their lifestyles or their belief, where the state and laws guarantee equal status for all minorities, whether they're faith-based, gender-based, sexual orientation-based, or dissent on political grounds. We've seen those failures already in Tunisia. We've seen those failures in Egypt. There's another strand to this that the writing of the constitution process in all of those countries has again negated equal status for women on a whole host of fronts. The broader point I'm trying to get to is that whatever government or form of government comes into place in Syria, what we're seeing is the emergence of majoritarian thinking in the Middle East, that as long as Sunni Muslim majorities of some sort rule via Islamist governments, we're expected to say that, oh, this is some kind of democracy now, regardless of their abandonment of the constitution or quelling of the judiciary or the desire to put religious minorities and second-class citizens. All of that is being put to a side in the name of majoritarian governments. And those are the trends that we're seeing from North Africa to even to some extent in Yemen. So to believe that somehow Syria will go against that trend, I mean, the evidence isn't there yet. So I would question the premise of the question and say that we are not yet on a trajectory towards what we would consider to be free, liberal, genuine democracy. Elections and majorities ruling by their interpretation of what should be a democracy isn't necessarily one that is in line with universal human rights.
I would agree with what Ed said. I would just add, one point, which is simply that I think what is happening in Syria has had a very overall a regional deleterious effect overall in the region on the prospects for peaceful change in the Arab world, which is what the Arab uprisings, when they broke out, were meant to sort of embody. I think the violence, the tremendous violence in Syria, have strengthen the hands of repressive leaders in the region who can point to Syria and say, you see, this is what you get when order breaks down. And given the importance of order in the Arab state system and the Middle East state system, it's a very compelling argument. And it also provides an added incentive to those who believe that the only way for change is through violence. So I'd say the net effect on, let's say, proto-democratization, in agreement with what Ed is saying, that this is not really about democratization, but it's sort of about laying the groundwork for democratization, has been a net negative.
Thank you. Next question.
Next question will come from University of the South.
the United States historically, when it comes to military intervention, has used a wide array of means, from the deployment of Marine troops to special forces training local inhabitants, with an emphasis on air superiority and airstrikes. And even in Somalia, a mixture of the two, with ranger forces along with special operations troops, which do you believe is more likely to be used in Syria, and which do you believe will be the most effective if used?
I would just, you know, I'm not a military specialist, but I would argue I just don't see a paramount role for U.S. military engagement, even of a limited sort. I mean, I think, you know, if and when or should Assad go, and should the Syrian army prove incapable of securing the country, there will need to come a point in which an international coalition will need to come together and forged as either a peacemaking, if not peace-preserving a mission. And the most I can see the U.S. providing is really technical, logistical, intelligence, perhaps even air assistance. But I think I'd be very surprised to see any U.S. troops on the ground in Syria under just about any scenario other than such a deterioration in the situation that the threat of weapons of mass destruction being employed had really reached a critical threshold.
Ed, do you want to add anything before we take the next question?
Very briefly, just to add to what Rob said and go further down the road in response to the questioner, if Syria were to become home, much like Pakistan or Yemen, for al-Qaeda and its affiliated terrorist camps, it's not inconceivable. They are already fighting from, you know, several countries in the region as well as from European countries. Their presence is there. Their presence is documented. They're boasting about it on their own websites. If those elements then find a home in parts of Syria, it's not inconceivable that the United States would then use unmanned aircraft or what's been referred to as drone attacks to eliminate terrorist suspects. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm saying it's worth us considering that that's a real possibility down the road.
Thank you. Next question.
Next question will come from CWU.
I think you meant TWU, Texas Women's University. This is Michael, and thank you for an interesting discussion. Just wondered for our experts on the panel, this is a very thought-provoking discussion. Please share with us what you would advise or recommend be done differently among the global leaders to resolve this crisis in Syria.
Who is going to start with your magic ball?
I can go ahead, Rob. I mean,
what's that?
I can go ahead.
Please.
You might collect your thoughts for a moment, a wiser head. My broad contention is that the United States' role on balance thus far is not one that can be criticized for on too many fronts. I hear Rob's critique, but I mean, the U.S., the main principle should be do no harm. And my concern is even at this stage, greater U.S. involvement would lead to greater harm on one simple ground, and that is, yes, we want to see Assad removed, but we don't know the abilities or the full composition of the opposition. And if I were to identify one key strand of work that's still underdeveloped, that still can be done without greater expense in either blood or treasure, that is urgently staring us in the face, and that is trying in some desperate way to unite the different opposition factions, both inside and outside, particularly outside Syria. The ongoing infighting, whether it's to do with finances, power games, sectarian advantage, closer access to the U.S., you know, positioning for ministerial positions when Assad falls, for a whole host of reasons, the infighting displayed by the Syrian opposition should give us serious thought for concern as to you know, what happens if, I mean, if they can't unite now with Assad in power to topple him, what happens when Assad falls? And if there was one area that had focus and tried to draw greater attention to, and the U.S. has been doing this, but you know, it's a two-way system. It's more up onto opposition to realize the stakes that are on the table, and I don't think they realize that enough. And if there was one area that would focus more, it would be the opposition. Secondly, in terms of what other countries can do, I mean, Syria isn't on its own. Syria, Rob mentioned, is absolutely vital to the region for the borders that it draws with other countries. I would urge countries such as Syria, Turkey, Iraq, Lebanon, Jordan, to meddle less inside Syria, you know, and even to some of the Gulf countries and the meddling that's been going on. And what that then allows for is ordinary Syrians that want greater freedom and accountability and transparent governance inside their countries, that they become, as they increasingly are becoming, pawns to different regional players. And what's happening now is the setting up of the different battalions and fighting groups. It's become a job. It's a full-time occupation for some. They dispatch the family members to the refugee camps, and the young men stay and fight, and they're getting huge amounts of money for doing so. Good luck to them. I'm not criticizing that. But my concern is they become professional fighters after Assad falls, and they continue to draw incomes from the YouTube videos they send to their Gulf donors, rather than realize that this is a short-term operation in order to remove Assad. But in the absence of other jobs and other forms of income, fighting becomes a permanent mode of sustenance. So I mean, there are lots of things that can be done, but those would be my two initial points, that the opposition works towards greater unity with external support and caveats and conditions, without which there's no real motivation. Assad being in power doesn't seem to be enough. And secondly, less meddling from regional countries that leads to the detriment of Assad's Syria. But more importantly, when Assad leaves, the Syria that they're helping create is not one that would fall in line with the vision of the various countries that are meddling.
Just to put my two cents worth, I believe the question was sort of what would each of us do differently. You know, I start off my comments by saying this is true, one of the, you know, almost a perfect example of a true foreign policy dilemma, one where there are no good answers, only bad choices. So I say any recommendations or any criticisms are said with great deal of humility and with great deal of empathy towards those who have to grapple with these choices, having been proximate to those kind of choices in the past. I know what a burden of responsibility it is, so I say it with great humility, and I don't think this is easy, and I think the policies that have been adopted are quite understandable. That said, I think that the activity that we've seen in the region by regional parties show that, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. There is a conflict there. It is sucking in other regional parties. It has become increasingly a sectarian and a regional conflict. And the question is simply, you know, what does a hands-off approach do? Perhaps I reveal my own background and training, but I, you know, as a former diplomat, I do believe in diplomacy as an important tool of statecraft. If military force is not an option, then you know, diplomacy is another tool. And I'm not sure that we've exhausted. In fact, I'm sure we have not exhausted all the tools at our disposal towards trying to advance a vision of Syria for the post-war period. There, I think we need to really ensure that our regional allies are really are pulling in the right direction, that their interests are the same or as close to as the same as ours as possible. I don't believe that our allies in the region actually do share our same interests, and that concerns me a great deal. And therefore, it argues all the more for more engagement rather than less. It does mean we need to be cautious, and especially when it comes to putting American lives and treasure in on the ground. That said, I just think there needs to be a lot more leadership exerted
Ed pointed out that, you know, well, why should the U.S. have to do this? Well, I believe that, you know, and then now we get into a very sort of macro philosophical question. But, you know, at the end of the day, I don't believe with the absence of U.S. leadership, any other single party will do it or can do it. So I think we do have a certain responsibility or burden of leadership here. And the cost is quite low. Appointing a special Syrian envoy or envoy to the Syrian conflict to really actively work to lead a diplomatic effort to ensure you know, that all is being done to coordinate for the day after. I mean, a lot of that is being done, but without a high level attention, a high level exposure. I'd like to hear the president speak more about it. I'd like to hear the new Secretary of State speak more about it. I'd like this to remain at the top of the agenda, even if our tools for addressing it are very limited.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question will come from Boston College.
Hi. Given the ascension of General Salim Idris to the top of the Free Syrian Army and the increasing dominance of Islamists within the FSA, and given the increasing effectiveness of Jabhat al-Nusra, what are the prospects of cooperation between al-Nusra and the FSA, and what can the United States do to undermine this cooperation? Thanks.
Ed, do you want to take it?
Sure, Bob. I mean, it's an excellent question, and I don't think it's... The U.S. has tried by banning Jabhat al-Nusra or by referring to it as a terrorist organization, rather than not banning it, but referring it, putting it on the global list of terrorist organizations late last year, and therefore compelling the Free Syrian Army and the Syrian National Council to further isolate the Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda front organization, for those of you who aren't aware, inside Syria. But you see, at a 30,000-feet level, that makes sense. And the Syrian National Council and the Free Syrian Army would say, as they have continued to say, that they are opposed to al-Qaeda elements, that they are not working side by side with Jabhat al-Nusra. But look at it from the point of view of someone who is on the ground fighting, whether it's from the FSA or other factions, and their most loyal, deadliest, effective fighters who have no compunction in going into whether it's Assad's military bases or whether it's destroying oncoming tanks by using suicide bombings or other means, no reservations whatsoever, to give up their lives. And in addition to that, they're prepared to impose some kind of law and order into parts of Syria that they're taking and bring out mosque imams as important judges for citizens who have complaints. So, you know, in parts of Syria where the Jabhat al-Nusra has taken control, what they've immediately imposed is their understanding of Sharia as state law. Villagers understand that reference point. They appreciate the safety that Jabhat al-Nusra brings. Compare that to elements of the Free Syrian Army that then go on to loot and to pillage and not to impose law and order. Ordinary Syrians are seeing the difference, and they see that these Jabhat al-Nusra people, however much we hate it, bring a greater level of coherence, order, security, fighting capacity that the Free Syrian Army thus far hasn't been able to marshal. So do the maths. At this stage, without external support, be it from Turkey, other Arab countries, or the European Union, without any other fighting backup, why would the Free Syrian Army on the ground, no matter what the high command says, no matter what's being said in Ankara and Washington, D.C., and in Doha, why would they give up their most effective allies at this point? It just doesn't make strategic sense on the ground at this juncture to do so. What happens after Assad falls is a different question, but I'm open to the criticism that you can't then dictate that Assad's successors or whoever comes into place after Assad in Syria abandons Jabhat al-Nusra then, having used them at this point. But my hunch is realpolitik suggests that that's exactly what's going to happen, that these will be, much like in Afghanistan, the fighters that fight the Soviet Union. The Jabhat al-Nusra people will be the fighters who are effectively fighting the Ba'ath Party operations. And once the Ba'ath Party disappears, it is they who will be on the receiving end of whether it's drone attacks or whether it's counterterrorism measures from regional powers or whether it's a new government forced to uproot, as is happening in parts of Libya, the very people that helped remove the previous government.
Thank you. Next question.
Thanks.
Our next question will come from Bush School.
Hi, I have a question about the success of the opposition so far in two ways, if you could comment. First, how much territory do they control? How much desirable territory do they control? And second, how good are they militarily compared to the Assad regime? Are they successful? Are they better? Are they worse? Are they at parity? Could you just give us a sense of how good these rebels are at fighting and occupying space?
Well, I'll just make one observation, then Ed, unless Ed, you wanted to go first. I mean,
go ahead, Rob. Go ahead.
I mean, I would just say, you know, look, this is a group that started off ill-prepared for military confrontation. It started off as a peaceful protest that was then descended as the Syrian regime acted brutally. And, you know, increasingly as soldiers have defected, as the opposition is mobilized. I mean, it has proven itself, I think, surprisingly effective at inflicting pain on the Syrian military, at providing insecurity to the regime and to the army so that it cannot, so its supply lines, its lines of transit are no longer secure. The strategy adopted by the opposition has not been to conquer territory, because that's where it has a comparative weakness. It's been to inflict pain and then to retreat. And there, you know, it has been effective. It has at times taken territory and held it for limited periods of time. Especially, it's been effective when it comes to weapons arsenals, and that's been a major source of its own strengthening of itself. But this is not an equal fight, and the tactics employed are not that of two rival armies. This is guerrilla warfare, asymmetric warfare employed by militias that are seeking to undermine the support and will of the army, not to defeat it on the battleground where it has no real comparative advantage.
Do you want to weigh in, or should we take the next question?
Let's take the next question. That was comprehensive
enough. Great, thank you.
Thank you. Next question will come from University of Pennsylvania.
Oh, hi. I was just wondering about how much of a priority this conflict is to Russia right now, and how you see their role playing out in the future, and what the stakes are for Russia, how much they do want to intervene if they think they have to at all.
Should I take a crack at it, Rob?
Please.
For Russia, Syria is their last Arab ally. The Russian diplomats are on the record openly talking about the fact that what they see is this is a Western, Turkish, plus Saudi or Gulf attempt to reconfigure the entire Middle East in a way that isolates not just Russia, but China, and further consolidates U.S. influence over the region. We may disagree with that analysis, but there are those are convictions that are held inside Moscow, but also in among lots of Arabs who see that this is essentially a fight for greater U.S. domination of the region. I'm not saying I agree with it, but I think it's an important dimension to the way they're looking at it. For Russia, the Assad regime, both this and the father, have been staunch allies for over 40 years. Russia has helped train the highest echelons of the Syrian military. Russians and Syrians have had marital ties for many years, because large numbers of Syrians have been going to study at Russian universities since the 1970s. And today, Russia, as I just said, sees the need to protect Assad as a way of pushing back against complete U.S. domination in a region that it considers that it once had a lot of influence over and wants to continue to see some level of influence over. And I think there are domestic concerns as well that, you know, it goes back to the point about precedent. I mean, if Assad falls, if protesters are able to mobilize on the streets and then rely on global intervention, what happens to a sitting government? And those are, I think, important questions for Russian domestic concerns. But the main concern isn't domestic. That's an indirect issue. But the more imminent concerns are great power, if you like, influence in the region, and and trying to contest greater American influence there.
We are at the end of our hour. I don't know, Robert, if you want to make some concluding remarks to that question as well before we wrap up.
No, I agree with everything Ed said.
Okay. Thank you both. We really appreciate you taking the time, and I know we have many, many people questions that we did not get to on the line, so I really truly apologize for that. If you would like, you should follow both Ed and Robert at their respective Twitter accounts, Ed_Hussein, and it's Robert Dineen. So you can search for them on Twitter, and you can also weigh in on Robert Dineen's blog, Middle East Matters. You can comment there. And just to let you all know, we are launching a new feature here at CFR. We're going to be collecting questions from students, and we will feature one every day with an answer from a CFR fellow. So for those of you who do not have a chance to get your questions asked, please email educators@cfr.org with your question, and we'll keep Ed Hussein and Robert Dineen very busy with answering them. So
Absolutely.
I hope you'll I'm volunteering you both all your
you.
Free time to please send us questions. Again, educators@cfr.org. Include your question, your first and last name, the school that you attend, and if you have your own Twitter account, include your handle, and we'll be tweeting out about the questions that we end up posting with the answers. So thank you all for your participation today.
Thank you, Irina.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rob.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.